Welcome, everyone, and we feel very fortunate and honored to have such a wonderful group of people to share information with us. And I've spoken with all of you before, except for Dr. Shankman, and I would thought that, you know, that this would maybe be a repeat of some older information, but I'm actually feeling that it's quite important we speak with you because we've actually had a lot of speakers. And they've all had a lot of wonderful, smart things to say, but they don't all match up. So I was hoping to ask you all some important questions. So let's get started. The first question that I would like to ask is about heart and heart disease. And the question is, Dr. Esselstyn, you have made a lot of people happy. You've said that you could become heart attack proof with the right diet and lifestyle. And I guess I want to, again, come back to this question because I'm still not sure what other people are saying. So if someone eats an ideal diet and lifestyle, what percent of heart attacks or deadly heart attacks and strokes, this is for all the cardiologists, what percent of those can we eliminate? Is this That's the question. What percent does the research support can really be completely eliminated, in your opinion, based on ideal diet and lifestyle? And I'd like to ask all the cardiologists to comment on that question first.
Well, I'd like to, take a crack at it first. I think that the truth be known, coronary artery disease is nothing more than a toothless paper tiger that need never, ever exist. And if it does exist, it need never, ever progress. And we have seen that now time after time after time over close to 30 years now. And we've written this up in the literature. The key, as far as I'm concerned, is to have be very, very completely accurate with patients if you're going to have them achieve the status of being a heart attack proof. By that, I mean, I like to make sure that they're not eating one single morsel that is going to further injure an already train wrecked endothelium. Because when the endothelium is unable to make nitric oxide, then we've lost our great ally. Because nitric oxide, with its wonderful functions, actually keeps all the cellular elements flowing without being sticky. It actually is the strongest blood vessel dilator. It protects the artery from becoming thick and stiff or inflamed. And the absolute bottom line is that a safe and adequate amount of nitric oxide will protect us all from ever developing any blockages or plaque. So literally, everybody on the planet Earth who has cardiovascular disease, whether they're from London, Berlin, Chicago, New York, or Cleveland, if they have this disease, it is because by now in the previous decades, they have so sufficiently trashed, injured, compromised, and turned their endothelial system into an absolute train wreck that we no longer have enough nitric oxide to protect us from making blockages and plaque. For example, you never saw a heart attack in an eight-year-old boy or girl. They have nitric oxide coming out of their ears. But we have to remember this is age dependent. So even when somebody is beautifully healthy at age 50, they have 50% of the nitric oxide they had when they were age 25, and by the time you're 80, you've lost 70%. However, I think that there's several things that you can do to further stimulate the endothelial production of nitric oxide, and at the same time, take full advantage of the newer research that shows that there is an alternate pathway for mankind to make nitric oxide. I'll stop there.
Dr. Williams, Dr. Shankman.
Go ahead, Cather. You wrote a book.
Sure. So I agree with much of what Dr. Esselstyn has said. I treat people in what I consider to be a fairly real world setting. I've got enthusiasts of Dr. Campbell and Dr. Esselstyn's work. And I also see patients who don't eat a vegetable or a fruit on any given day and everything in between. And yes, with an ideal lifestyle, you can probably get through your life in all likelihood without having cardiovascular disease till you're at a pretty significantly older age. The statistic that I've seen quoted from American Heart Association is that 80% of all cardiovascular disease is preventable by changes in lifestyle.
Well said. It's interesting you had mentioned the American Heart Association. They and the American College of Cardiology get together and put out guidelines specifically for primary prevention, Steve. And when you look at the recommendations on diet, not smoking, not using aspirin unless it's necessary, all the things that we said in those 2019 guidelines, including the nutrition recommendations, management of diabetes and hypertension and high cholesterol, they're not being followed. They're not being followed by patients. They're not being followed by physicians. And it's one of the things that we fail to do. We put together all the literature, but we don't necessarily focus on implementation strategies. That's something that I think we could do better as medical societies and as physicians and as patients. And so my take on this is I agree with what's been said. You could say that this, in an ideal world, is a paper tiger and would never occur. But in the areas that I've worked, south side of Chicago, west side of Chicago, midtown Detroit, we have healthcare disparities, and a lot of it's cardiovascular. And everybody hears about gangs and drugs in these areas, but it's still cardiovascular disease, and it's renal disease. And when you look at the African American population having a 21% higher cardiovascular death rate than other races, you look at the chronic kidney disease, and in our society, people don't die of chronic kidney disease so much, they die of heart disease because it generates so much heart disease to have your kidneys not working. It's 13% of the population and 35% of the dialysis patients. And so the nutrition is a special challenge, and there are people working hard on this. I don't know how much traction we're getting. But you had Columbus Matisse doing the slave food, and people are shocked at that sort of, why would you go back to, so many years ago and start talking about diet? Well, it's because our community is still eating the stuff that, so-called low on the hog. But talking to Columbus Matisse, that's not really all of it means. He's also talking, that's not the only thing that it means. He's also talking about our enslavement to food. Okay. And so, and particularly the sugar, the refined carbohydrates, it's hard for imagine, and I have to call out my animal rights and planet sustainability colleagues here for eating the refined grains and the sugar and the juicing and things that have, at least by one article from Nurses Health at Harvard, says that diet is actually worse than eating animals. And it makes sense. They generates a lot of high insulin levels. Insulin develops plaque. And so an unhealthy plant-based diet may be actually one of the worst things that we could do. I kind of tease my vegan colleagues who are eating that kind of stuff, the vegan cupcakes, the vegan donuts, and all this stuff, that it's really good for the planet. No greenhouse gases, gets rid of humans. Perfect. Okay. But that's, not what we should be about in healthcare.
Dr. King. Sure.
I'd like to make a comment, even though I've had zero experience like my colleagues here in the cardiac heart disease, but I certainly have been interested from a nutritional perspective. There is, in my view, and this is a really important question. I'm really happy to hear what Dr. Williams and Dr. Esselstyn said. But let me share with you some other data that has been around quite a long time that's been fairly persuasive for me, at least. In 1959, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Norman Jolliffe, he worked in the Caribbean, but he was British in his origin. In any case, he published a comparison of heart disease rates, mortality actually, heart disease mortality for a bunch of different countries. And he then plotted it against, of all things, animal protein. I'm gonna just show you here. You see that right there?
Not too well, it's hard.
No, that's okay. Can you see it better?
Yeah, keep going.
Okay. You see that?
Yes.
Okay, well, what I want to demonstrate here is the fact that this is a correlation study, of course. On the y-axis, it's coronary heart disease deaths. And on the x-axis at the bottom is amount of animal protein being consumed. That line was really incredibly impressive because it's a linear regression. It's going straight down, going right down through the XY origin. So in theory, what it suggested at that time, and this is 1950s, okay, at the beginning of my career, that if we get all the way down to zero, almost zero animal protein intake, then heart disease is non-existent, okay? Now, I know I'm not talking about animal protein per se or specifically. I'm talking about, obviously, in this case, it was an animal protein-based diet, okay? Then we in turn, so that suggested that in theory, at least, if you avoid completely the animal protein consumption or animal food consumption, that the heart disease rate would be close to zero. So then in our study in China, and one of the reasons that caught my attention on that, because in our study in China, where we actually looked at coronary death rates for a total of 130 different villages across the country, we have got something very similar. It was down to on the low end, there was something like 165,000 consecutive what do you guys call it? Death certificates, I guess it is. Not one was heart disease, not one. At the same time that there was, that heart disease was essentially non-existent in certain areas of China. At the same time, their cholesterol levels were much lower, shockingly lower than anything we knew in the West. It raised the average cholesterol, serum cholesterol values across those different different villages ranged from a low of 88, this is total cholesterol, by the way, 88 total milligrams per deciliter, up to a high of 160. These are averages. The mean cholesterol level in that population showing essentially no heart disease at the lower end, the mean cholesterol level is 127. At the time that we came up with these data, Bill Castelli, I was a friend of Bill Castelli, and I'm sure that Dr. Williams and Dr. Esselstyn knew him well. But in any case, he thought this was pretty amazing, and I was challenging, hey, you got to go back and analyze those data, get those samples again. And we did two more times, got the same results, essentially. Then Castelli came on board, too, and said that was his own view, that these really low cholesterol levels, unseen in the Western countries, should be related to virtually, you know, quite frankly, almost no heart disease rates. And I had this plot here from Jello. And so what this has led me to believe, that at least taking this more global perspective, I find it really impressive. And I find it impressive not just because of the association of serum cholesterol with the coronary heart disease death rates, but also that the same plot here has appeared in probably at least 10 other studies ever since that time, not necessarily in reference specifically to animal protein-based diets, but essentially it was the same thing. They just used other things because people didn't want to talk about animal protein. And then finally, one final comment. Way back in 1909, in fact, a Russian scientist who was interested in the high cholesterol levels, they were allegedly related possibly to cardiovascular disease, he started working a little bit on the causes of that, came up with a suggestion it was animal protein. It wasn't total fat. Then it was about 10, 12 research groups between then and 1926 that did sort of worked on that question. Finally, in 1926, there was a group at the University of Michigan that concluded rather conclusively and strongly, it was animal protein was, they called it, the cause of heart disease, not saturated fat. Not cholesterol itself. So because consumption of cholesterol was, for a long time is, supposed to be the cause of heart disease. But in fact, you look at the biochemical level, look at those kind of analyses in that way. It was really the animal, just the mere idea that they should be consuming animal protein, which of course means more cholesterol consumption, of course, more saturated fat and so forth and so on. So that combination of data there, I'm sorry for going on so long, but together, collectively, I found those data really impressive. That in theory, that, you know, if we could, we could apparently get to virtually no heart disease. That's one of the things I became so attracted to when Dr. Essler and I first talked, and he started talking about his study about reversal of heart disease. That was in the back of my mind, because I knew that from the late 1950s and 60s. And, you know, and then, well, I won't go into all those details, but I guess I was really impressed with what he and Dr. Ornish had shown, that this was really quite spectacular.
So if I could just respond to that, I know there's a lot of folks from a lot of different directions are saying that cholesterol is not the culprit. You know, if you look at the stuff of George Abella in Michigan State, and you could just put that in your search engine and look at his images, cholesterol certainly is a major part of it. If you get above a certain saturation level, it's kind of like that experiment that you did in fifth grade with the sugar and the string and the glass, and it got to a certain concentration and then it crystallized, except that when cholesterol crystals occur, they actually are sharp edges and they can actually make plaque ruptures. So it makes sense that lowering cholesterol, never letting it get to a critical level so that it can crystallize or precipitate is important. However, I have to give a lot of credence to what you're saying, that the image that you showed looks very much like the cholesterol trialist data, with a linear reduction in cardiovascular events and mortality as the LDL cholesterol goes down. But how about, you know, is oxidized LDL more important? And that's why smokers get in trouble with the same amount of LDL, because it's oxidized. And then there's the whole TMAO, trimethylamine N-oxide issue. And when you're eating things that raise your cholesterol, you're typically eating things that raise your TMAO levels. And you mentioned saturated fat. And then you have inflammation. And I try to tell my patients that when you eat, I'm sorry to be graphic, but when you eat the decaying carcass of a murdered animal, you actually end up with inflammation. Why wouldn't you? And it actually affects your microbiome, okay? Because that decaying flesh is decaying for a reason. It has a microbiome in and of itself, and then you're putting that in your GI tract. That generates a lot of the Cleveland Clinic's data on Dr. Esselstyn's colleagues, their data on trimethylamine N-oxide, TMAO. But it also is responsible for the changes in the microbiome that are associated with way more than heart disease. It's a variety of neurologic diseases, chronic kidney disease that I mentioned before. And so we really should give credence that, you know, our focus on LDL, and the reason that all our plant-based dieters do better is because they're getting rid of a variety of things: the TMAO, the inflammation, the LDL cholesterol, the oxidation of LDL, and the saturated fat.